Welcome, everyone, to the undisclosed addendum for the State v. Jamar Huggins. Our sponsors for this week's addendum include our most comfortable sponsor, Mack Weldon, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, and Zola Wedding Registry. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at EvidenceProfBlog. For the addendum this season in connection with the Jamar Huggins case, I'll be doing two things. First, I'll be delving deeper into some of the legal issues raised by the episodes. And second, I'll be answering your listener questions. In this episode, I'm going to explore three legal issues and then answer some of your questions. Part 1, reasonable doubt. To convict a defendant in the U.S., jurors must find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The issue of what guilty beyond a reasonable doubt means was most recently before the Supreme Court in the 1979 case, Jackson v. Virginia.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the issue before the court today is whether a federal district court should issue a writ of habeas corpus when there is insufficient evidence in the state court record to convince a rational trier of fact of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
In Jackson, the Supreme Court concluded that the beyond a reasonable doubt standard requires jurors to be in a subjective state of near certitude regarding the defendant's guilt. Now, the court has found that this is an inherently subjective standard that is not subject to quantification, such as by the prosecutor telling jurors that they can return a guilty verdict if they're, say, 80 or 90% certain of guilt. In most cases, then, a defendant's fate is left in the hands of the 12 men and women in the jury box who will apply their own definition of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That said, there is one circumstance where the case won't reach the jury. At the close of the prosecution's case and or the close of the defense's case, the defendant can make a motion for a directed verdict. Such a motion claims that the evidence is such that no reasonable juror could find the defendant guilty. The judge grants a motion for a directed verdict, the case is dismissed. For instance, here's audio from a Tennessee case in which Judge James Randall instructs the jury after granting a motion for a directed verdict.
I have some news for you that depending on your perspective, may be welcome or it may be disappointing. The news is this. Based on the work that the lawyers and I have been doing, this case has now come to an end. You'll not be asked to deliberate and render a verdict.
This takes me to research being done by one of our students here at the University of South Carolina School of Law, Chelsea Evans. Chelsea actually received the top grade in my criminal law class, and I've been working with her on her student note, which argues that South Carolina should pass a wrongful conviction compensation statute. She sat down and talked with me about her research, and I'll include more of that audio in a future addendum. But one of the cases she came across in her research involved the case out of Conway, the same city as the crime in the Jamar Huggins case, and it involved a motion for a directed verdict, which, as you'll see, was also part of the Huggins case. Here's Chelsea talking about the case.
So one of the cases I came across was Robert Palmer. I came across this case just looking at different news articles to try to find cases of wrongful conviction in South Carolina. Mr. Palmer was incarcerated for about 4 years for homicide by child abuse and the death of a 17-month-old baby. So at the time of the incident, Palmer was dating the co-defendant who was the victim's grandmother, and the grandmother was temporarily keeping the child while the child's mother was out of town. So the co-defendant, you know, admitted to mistreating the victim and whatnot, but Palmer maintained his innocence the entire time. And he claimed that he had no knowledge of what caused the child's injuries, and he denied any involvement, but ultimately he was also sentenced to prison. In 2015, the South Carolina Supreme Court determined that there was insufficient evidence to support a finding that, you know, Palmer either harmed the victim or was even aware that the co-defendant was harming him. And so they ultimately decided to overturn his conviction and he was released from prison. So, late last year, Palmer filed a lawsuit against the state of South Carolina, as well as some other local parties, for malicious prosecution, false arrest, and negligence. And basically, he cited in his complaint some of the things that he experienced. And that was one reason I included him in my paper, was because, you know, he basically discussed how, you know, the ordeal cost him his job and kept him away from his family, and really kind of highlighted some of those effects that people experience when they are released from prison, especially when they're wrongfully convicted.
The Robert Palmer case really is a great example of how anyone can be the victim of a wrongful conviction. Palmer was a U.S. Navy veteran with no criminal record at the time of his arrest. The only evidence that he might have had anything to do with the death of his girlfriend's grandson was that he was at the girlfriend's house at certain points in the day when the child lost his life. But despite the lack of any real evidence that Palmer killed or even injured the child, his motion for a directed verdict was denied, a decision that was upheld 2-1 by the Court of Appeals of South Carolina. According to that court, quote, "When ruling on a motion for a directed verdict, the trial court is concerned with the existence or non-existence of evidence, not its weight." What I'd say is, it's this standard that has led to any number of defendants being denied relief. Luckily, though, for Palmer, he did get relief. The Supreme Court of South Carolina later overturned his conviction, ruling as follows. The state would have the court speculate, despite the absence of any evidence, that both petitioners actually entered the victim's bedroom around 4:30 p.m., where one abused him in the presence of the other, thus aided and abetted the perpetrator by failing to seek medical help for an hour and a half. There is no evidence other than rank speculation that such an incident occurred. But while this decision meant that Palmer was released from prison, it doesn't mean that he was made whole. Palmer alleges in his lawsuit that his wrongful conviction cost him his job, kept him away from his family, and left him with nightmares about what he endured in prison. What's new? Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Mack Weldon promises that their products will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants you'll ever wear. And I can say personally as a customer, they make good in that promise. I have their socks, their boxer shorts, their undershirts, and they're the most comfortable clothes I've ever worn. But not only do Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well too. It's good for working out, going to work, going out on dates, everyday life. And now, as an undisclosed listener, you can go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code undisclosed. And they want you to be comfortable, so if you don't like the first pair, you can keep it and they'll still refund you. No questions asked. Again, that's MackWeldon.com, and you can get 20% off using the promo code undisclosed. Part 2. Mandatory Minimums. In this season's case, Jamar Huggins was convicted of first-degree burglary under Section 1611.311 of the South Carolina Code. This is a crime when a person enters a dwelling without consent and with the intent to commit a crime in the dwelling if one or more of five circumstances apply, including being armed with a dangerous weapon and causing physical injury to a victim. One of these circumstances, however, is simply, quote, "the entering or remaining occurred in the nighttime." I sat down with Jamie Rakowski, another South Carolina law student. Jamie is my research assistant and worked on our first-degree burglary case.
So I was actually working as a law clerk at the Richland County Public Defender's Office, and the attorneys there had this case with a young man underneath the age of 18. He was 16 or 17 at the commission of the crime.
Here were the facts of the case.
What we know is that there was a group of boys that planned on knocking on this woman's door, and they wanted to ask to use her phone, and they were expecting to get a cell phone. And what they were going to do is take the cell phone and just run off. But what happened was she handed them a house phone. So they gave it back to her. About an hour later, they decided to come back. And when they came back, they knocked on the door, pushed their way into the home, pushed her aside while doing that, while coming into the house. They grabbed a cell phone, a purse, maybe something else, but I know those two things for sure, and ran out.
While the homeowner was flustered, she wasn't injured, but the crime was still punishable as first-degree burglary.
He was charged with burglary in the first degree. Basically, what triggered it was that it happened at nighttime. That triggers the first-degree burglary statute, and the solicitors at the time, even though he was under the age of 18 and didn't have any record of violent crimes, decided to charge him without pleading him down, and there's a minimum sentence of 15 years for that in South Carolina.
I then asked Jamie what she thought about that 15-year mandatory minimum sentence based solely on the fact that the burglary was committed during the nighttime.
I think it is pretty crazy, honestly, that a juvenile who they decided to charge as an adult for pushing their way into a home and stealing, you know, a person you know, he made a bad decision, I get that, but having a 15-year minimum now that he has to serve 85% of at least, so he'll be 30 when he gets out for pushing into a home and grabbing a cell phone and keys and purse, he'll be out in his 30s for something that doesn't seem like it deserves that much time, that's for sure.
Jamie's not alone. Back in 2013, Attorney General Eric Holder announced an overhaul of mandatory minimum sentencing, at least in the context of federal drug crimes.
I am proud to announce today that the Justice Department will take a series of significant actions to recalibrate America's federal criminal justice system. We will start by fundamentally rethinking the notion of mandatory minimum sentences for drug-related crimes. Some statutes that mandate inflexible sentences, and this is regardless of the individual conduct that is at issue in a particular case, reduce the discretion available to prosecutors, judges, and to juries. Because they oftentimes generate unfairly long sentences, they breed disrespect for the system. When applied indiscriminately, they do not serve public safety. This is why I have today mandated a modification of the Justice Department's charging policy so that certain low-level, nonviolent drug offenders who have no ties to large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels will no longer be charged with offenses that impose draconian mandatory minimum sentences. They now will be charged with offenses for which the accompanying sentences are better suited to their individual conduct rather than excessive prison terms more appropriate for violent criminals or drug kingpins.
This wasn't a development that came out of nowhere. Back in 1993, then-Chief Justice William Rehnquist gave a speech in which he claimed that mandatory minimum sentencing is a paradigmatic example of the law of unintended consequences.
These mandatory minimum sentences are perhaps a good example of the law of unintended consequences. There is a respectable body of opinion which believes that these mandatory minimum impose unduly harsh punishment for first-time offenders, particularly for mules who played only a minor role in a drug distribution scheme. Be that as it may, the mandatory minimums have also led to an inordinate increase in the federal prison population, will require huge expenditures to build new prison space. Mandatory minimums have shifted some of the discretion to prosecutors in the discharging of offenses. They've required the Sentencing Commission to draft guideline sentences to accommodate the mandatory minimums and therefore tend to skew the guidelines towards overall greater severity in sentencing.
According to Rehnquist, the combination of mandatory minimums and the increasing federalization of crime has had tragic consequences for the American criminal justice system, similar to a story out of Greek mythology.
The political combination of creating a federal offense and attaching a mandatory minimum became a veritable siren song for Congress.
In other words, mandatory minimum sentencing schemes lead to unexpected drawbacks. But mandatory minimums have also led to perverse results. Mandatory minimums were put into place to limit the discretion of judges and ensure that there weren't sentencing disparities across race and class. But several studies have shown that mandatory minimums have led to a disproportionately longer sentence for African Americans, the poor, and the young. In the case that Jamie worked on, all three were at play.
He was a poor, lower income, obviously. He had a public defender, black boy from South Carolina that he was rolling with a not great crowd, but he didn't have a personal history, like I said, of any violent crimes or anything like that. So
that said, mandatory minimum sentences do serve a purpose, which is to tell victims in the community at large that criminals will be punished harshly for their crimes. As you heard in this first episode, a burglary can have consequences for residents for the rest of their lives, and burglaries committed during the nighttime are especially jarring to the security that someone is supposed to feel in their own home. Moreover, when mandatory minimum sentences aren't in place, it can lead to cases like the one involving the Stanford swimmer who was convicted of sexual assault.
At the offices of the California Commission on Judicial Performance, women's rights advocates delivered boxes representing nearly a million signatures collected online in recent days.
We have never come close to getting 1 million signatures on anything. So I think that this really speaks out to a groundswell of outrage.
The petitions call for the commission to take action against Santa Clara County Judge Aaron Persky, who last week sentenced former Stanford University swimmer Brock Turner to 6 months in jail for sexually assaulting an unconscious woman, even though prosecutors had recommended Turner get 6 years.
The judge's sentence in this case was unreasonably lenient, and the judge really bent over backwards to ensure that this young offender did not experience justice.
All of which goes to say there are no easy answers with regard to mandatory minimums. Living in the trees, never understanding. Keep it track of time, no real reason.
Time is moving on.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports Undisclosed. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interest in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Part 3, Victim Impact Statements. The same issues that exist with mandatory minimums apply to victim impact statements. In the first episode, I talked about the origins of victim impact statements in the U.S. Now, you might expect that such statements are routinely given in criminal cases, but a 1989 study done in South Carolina concluded that, quote, in cases in which the victim is notified and given the opportunity to make an impact statement at the time of sentencing, only 24% of victims exercise the right to do so. And similar to mandatory minimum sentences, studies have shown that victim impact statements are given much less in cases of poor and minority victims. This has led many to claim that the admission of victim impact statements, in effect, leads to the valuing of certain lives over others. In fact, it was this exact argument that was made in a 1987 Supreme Court case, Booth v. Maryland, about a death sentence handed down after the defendant was found guilty of a Baltimore homicide.
As I pointed out, Justice Scalia, if we accept that, then I think it becomes reasonable to weigh is, who was this victim in the community? Was he the surgeon that's going to save 1,000 lives, or was he the drug dealer who perhaps was going to eliminate lives? Are we going to have a system that's going to turn on some lives or worth giving more protection to than others? Because that's really what it comes down to.
In Booth, the Supreme Court banned the use of victim impact statements in capital cases, and it reaffirmed that decision 2 years later in South Carolina v. Gathers, a case involving a murder in Charleston, South Carolina. Of course, the other side of the issue is that victim impact statements give a voice to the voiceless and allow the jury to see the victim as a fully fleshed out person whose loss was meaningful, as opposed to a John or Jane Doe. And maybe that's why the Supreme Court reversed Booth in 1991 when it issued its decision in Payne v. Tennessee.
In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we hold that the Eighth Amendment erects no automatic bar prohibiting a capital sentencing jury from considering victim impact evidence relating to the victim's personal characteristics and the emotional impact of the murder on the victim's family, or precluding a prosecutor from arguing such evidence at a capital sentencing hearing. To the extent that they held to the contrary, Booth and Gathers are overruled. Booth and Gathers were based on several premises which we believe were faulty as a basis for enunciating a constitutional rule. One of these premises was that only evidence of blameworthiness on the part of the defendant is admissible at the sentencing stage, and that evidence relating to harm caused to the victim's family does not bear on that issue. The victim's rights movement is fairly recent in the law. It's based on the notion that in the process of apprehending and prosecuting criminal defendants, the interests of the victim and the victim's family are often lost sight of. The victim becomes simply a statistic.
So Payne held that there is no categorical prohibition to the admission of victim impact statements in capital cases, but when does a victim impact statement go too far? According to the court, there might be circumstances where such a statement is so unduly prejudicial that it renders the sentencing hearing fundamentally unfair. Unfortunately, though, besides that language, the Supreme Court has never provided any more guidance than that. And that's led to some prosecutors upping the ante. When Payne was decided, victim impact statements consisted of testimony or statements read by the prosecutor, like the one in the Jamar Huggins case. But now, prosecutors sometimes introduce victim impact videos. For example, here's a portion of the victim impact video introduced in the California case, People vs. Kelly.
As time goes by, I try very hard not to think of Sarah in terms of this terrible crime that we've had to deal with here in the court, but rather think of her in a place like this, which is, this was filmed in southern Alberta, the land where Sarah's people lived for so many generations. This is the kind of heaven she seems to belong in.
That's the mother of the victim narrating over Enya's version of I Dreamt I Dwelt in Marble Halls, which was most famously used in Martin Scorsese's film adaptation of The Age of Innocence. The entire video in the Kelly case runs about 20 minutes, and it contains photos of the victim from infancy to the age when her life was taken, all accompanied by Enya music. On appeal, the defendant claimed that this video was unduly prejudicial and therefore violated the Payne standard.
May it please the court. In Edwards, this court cautioned that allowing victim impact evidence under Factor A does not mean there are no limits on emotional evidence and argument. And in Prince, very recently, this court, when describing a victim impact video that would violate due process, this court described virtually word for word the video that was shown in this case. It was lengthy. It was set to very emotional music.
The Supreme Court of California disagreed in a 2007 opinion. They noted the existence of a Texas case in which the Court of Criminal Appeals of Texas found it was prejudicial to introduce a 17-minute victim impact video that included music such as Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On from the movie Titanic. But California's highest court concluded that in this case, quote, the music of Enya, with most of the words unrecognizable, plays in the background. The music is generally soft, not stirring. And because it was soft and not stirring, the court found it was not prejudicial. Now, the defendant tried to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which decided not to hear the case. But Justice Stevens dissented, writing, quote, having decided to tolerate the introduction of evidence that puts a heavy thumb on the prosecutor's side in the scale and death cases, the court has a duty to consider what reasonable limits should be placed in its use. Justice Breyer also dissented, concluding, quote, the film's personal, emotional, and artistic attributes themselves create the legal problem. They render the film's purely emotional impact strong, perhaps unusually so. Without any guidance from the Supreme Court, any limits in the admission of victim impact statements are uncertain, and that's potentially very troubling. In 2011, Raymond Paternoster and Jerome Deese conducted a study of 135 participants who watched the video of an actual capital trial. 73 of them watched the entire video, while 62 watched a version with the victim impact statements edited out. Of those who saw the entire video, 62% said they would impose a death sentence. Conversely, for the participants who saw only the edited video, only 17.5% said they would have voted for the death penalty. Wedding is likely to be one of the happiest days of your life and also one of the most stressful. So imagine the advantages of one site serving all the needs of couples. Zola is a one-stop registry. Couples can register for whatever they want, sheets, a wine subscription, or honeymoon funds. Then Zola works directly with over 450 brands so the happy couple can find whatever they want in one place. Brands include KitchenAid, SoulCycle, Le Creuset, Sonos, Ralph Lauren, and more. Some other benefits for couples. It's available everywhere. It's the highest rated app on the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch to register on the go. Love it or leave it. Couples can have gifts shipped now, later, or exchange them for something they'd really love. Group gifting. Multiple guests can contribute to bigger ticket gifts. Price matching. Zola offers price matching to make gift giving even easier for your guests. Help with thanks. Couples can export their list of gifts and senders to make sending those thank you notes a snap. Finally, love from Zola. couples will receive 10% off the entire site for a year to complete their registry. All the gifts, experiences, and funds you want all in one place. And now, Undisclosed listeners, you can receive $50 when you register and use Zola. Visit zola.com/UA for details. That's zola.com/UA. Part 4, Twitter questions. This first question comes from Tiffany Snook. Her Twitter handle is @SnookFamily. She asks, what in the world did Adrian do? Where is he at? Part of the answer to this will come in episode 2 when I'll discuss Detective Martin interviewing Adrian at the hospital. In terms of where he is now, I'm reading from the trial transcript from Detective Martin's testimony. He removed himself from the area, and I think part of it was medical, and we weren't able to locate where he was transferred to because of the medical background. So where he currently is, we're unsure. Where he was back in 2012, 2013, we'll discuss that in episode 2. The second question comes from Katie Arms. Her Twitter handle is @KatieWino, and she asks, was chocolate okay? You can't leave that out. So she's referring to Angela Eckler's chocolate lab, and the answer is chocolate was okay, although a bit shaken up. And so here's some audio that actually was cut for pacing from the first episode.
So I grabbed chocolate, come on. So I grabbed my keys, held Mariah's hand, opened everything and turned chocolate out. Let her go out first.
Yeah.
And once she got out, she went to barking like crazy.
Yeah.
Just being out here barking.
This next question comes from Rachel E. Moody. Her Twitter handle is @MaybeMoody. And she asks, did they leave prints in the house? I heard one had gloves on. Now, actually, Rachel, your thinking is similar to the thinking of Detective Martin in this case, because, as you noted, while one had gloves on, Eckler was uncertain whether the other assailant had gloves on, and therefore he decided to have touch DNA testing done. So what's touch DNA? Here's testimony by Dr. Julie Howenstein in a case out of Michigan. Touch DNA is samples that have cellular material transferred from some location on the body, not a biological fluid, and again, you naturally shed a lot of your cells, especially the skin cells and the surface of your skin in your hands, and those will, when you touch something or rub up against it, be transferred from your body to whatever object we're going to be testing for. Again, it's also possible if you've shed any body fluid that the cellular material in your bodily fluid is transferred to any type of what we call substrate or matter that we're going to test. So here's Detective Martin testifying at Jamar Huggins' trial, and I'm going to start in the middle of one of his answers. So I did take 2 swabs at the house for touch DNA. It'd be at a location where someone maybe just touched, their DNA might still be on the scene, and it was kind of a guess, just guessing because she wasn't very certain about where people had touched. She knew she had been held in the bathroom, and then also that someone had gone out the front door, you know, after they had come in on her, so that was about the only 2 places she could be 100% sure. Everywhere else would have just been swabbing for, you know, you don't know what you get. Question, and when you say touch DNA, that's a relatively new term of art in the legal world. What exactly does that mean? Answer, it used to be where DNA would be with blood or semen or spit, very strong DNA. Touch is a lot less quantity and strength. There's new methods of DNA identification where they can actually take a little bit and make it a lot, and from that, they can then compare it to a suspect or a victim or anybody else. So when there was touch DNA, you may not have a lot. Me touching this table right here is not going to look like me if I bled all over the counter here. So this little amount right here, I can take a swipe of it. They put it in what's called a PCR. It's called polymerase chain reaction. They put a bunch of stuff together, throw it in a machine, heats up, cools down, and makes lots of copies. With all those copies, they can compare it. It'd be just the same as looking at blood DNA. But ultimately in this case, Detective Martin was not able to find any touch DNA samples, and therefore no one could be included or excluded as a possible perpetrator of this crime. In other cases, though, touch DNA evidence has been used to inculpate or exculpate certain individuals, perhaps most famously in the case of the death of JonBenet Ramsey.
New technology helped exonerate the Ramsey family. Touch DNA analysis found the DNA of an unidentified male on JonBenet's long johns. It matched DNA that was found earlier on her clothing. Joining us is Angela Williamson, director of forensic casework at Bodie Technology Group in Virginia. She was the supervising scientist on the JonBenet Ramsey case. Good morning.
Good morning, Harry.
Please explain to us what touch DNA is.
Touch DNA is transferred every time someone touches someone or touches an object. Essentially, if you touch your hand to your shoulder, without gloves on obviously, mm-hmm. you're shedding skin cells. And so you're leaving behind some DNA in the form of those skin cells when you touch someone or something.
So instead of like on a CSI episode, we don't have to find a fingernail or a shred of skin or even a drop of blood. You can find this DNA somebody from touching something.
Yes, exactly, and touch DNA is not visible. So the way to find it is to try and anticipate where that person has touched the victim, mm-hmm. or actually if the victim is surviving, to tell you where they were grabbed, where they were held down during the assault.
But recently there have been a lot of questions raised about whether touch DNA evidence can actually connect a person to a crime definitively.
But here's the problem. Several studies have now concluded the false positive rate could be as high as 20%. One study had the test subject shake hands with another person and then grab a knife. The other person's DNA was recovered from the knife on many occasions. Defense attorneys are seizing on this new information. One at a forensics meeting recently in Las Vegas concluded the misidentification is probably more prevalent than we think. The issue is front and center in a California homicide case where the defendant's DNA linked him to the crime. The problem? He had a rock-solid alibi. Investigators theorized that paramedics who treated him earlier in the day then transported his DNA to the crime scene where criminalists recovered it.
This clip is referencing the case of Lucas Anderson, who is charged with murdering millionaire Ravish Kumra in California. After Anderson spent 5 months in prison, it was determined that Anderson had become so intoxicated on the day of the murder that he was taken to the hospital and treated by paramedics. Those same paramedics then responded to the scene of the Kumra murder and transferred Anderson's DNA to the crime scene, with Anderson's alibi being that he was still at the hospital at the time of the murder. So, as with much forensic evidence, a grain of DNA sometimes needs to be taken with a grain of salt. This next question comes from Rachel E. Moody. Her Twitter handle is @MaybeMoody, and she asks, did the guy take the daughter's money or not? Affidavit said some, mom said none. Excellent episode. Yeah, so Rachel's referring to the money in the birthday card that might have been stolen in whole, in part, or not at all. And the answer here is the investigators didn't seem too concerned with whether property was stolen. And that's, again, because the definition of burglary I mentioned earlier in the episode. So burglary is defined as when a person enters a dwelling without consent and with the intent to commit a crime. So you might at first, when you're thinking about burglary, think of, let's say a person enters a home, they have the goal of stealing something, and they're caught before they can steal it. That you might think of as attempted burglary, but that's not true, because the crime of burglary is completed the second the person enters the home with the goal of stealing something, regardless of whether they actually steal anything. And that's probably why in this case the investigators weren't too concerned with whether any actual property was stolen in the case. This next question comes from Rachel Miglior, and her Twitter handle is @RachelEely. She asks, you said everyone in the courtroom was shocked by the outcome and there was very little evidence. Did the defense attorney move for a judgment of acquittal / directed verdict? Yeah, and so as I alluded to earlier in this episode, there was a motion for a directed verdict in this case, and a motion for a judgment of acquittal is the exact same thing as a motion for a directed verdict. In fact, in federal court, there's Rule 29 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which defines it as a judgment of acquittal as opposed to a directed verdict. In South Carolina, we call it a directed verdict. But yeah, same thinking, and there are plenty of cases where parties move for a judgment of acquittal, and in most cases it's denied, perhaps most famously in the case of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. And so here's some audio of the end of the defense argument and the judge's ruling in the Trayvon Martin-George Zimmerman case.
Good Lord, let's be realistic. We know who had the injuries, we know who didn't. It was a sad and tragic affair, but Trayvon Martin did in fact cause his own death, and this man should not face a jury any longer than he has already.
Thank you both very much for your arguments. I have reviewed all of the case law and listened very closely to your arguments. The court finds that the state has presented sufficient evidence, both direct and circumstantial, to allow his charge to go to the jury. The motions for judgment of acquittal are denied.
And so as I noted, there was a motion for a directed verdict in the Jamar Huggins case, and I'll have more detail on that in a future episode. This final question comes from Loris Kifume. Her Twitter handle is @BairdR, and she asks, why this case? Some personal backstory would be cool. And the answer is, I was sent a series of articles done by journalist Isaac Bailey for the Sun News about this case, and it really intrigued me. And for those of you interested, you can either check out those articles now, it's a series called Reasonable Doubt, or if you want to wait and see how things unfold with a podcast and then check them out after the fact, that would make sense as well. So Isaac Bailey at the Sun News, it's a series of 5 articles on Reasonable Doubt, and it's discussing the Jamar Huggins case. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. If you're interested in contributing to Jamar Huggins' legal defense fund, you can do so by going to www.fundedjustice.com/JamarHuggins. And believe me, every dollar counts. The music you heard in this episode is Shaky Ground by Ward Dunn and his band Pluto Wilson. Their music is available at plutowilson.bandcamp.com. The rework theme for this season's addenda was written by Ramiro Marquez, performed by Mark Augustin, and produced by Patrick Cortez. In addition, I'd like to thank the following people. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production. Hannah McCarthy for her audio production. Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management. Baluki for our logo. And Mital Telhan, our executive producer. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using @UndisclosedPod. You can tweet about the case by using the hashtag JusticeForJamar. And you can tweet me questions for upcoming addenda by using the hashtag UDAddendum. And finally, in 2017, the University of South Carolina School of Law celebrates 150 years of contributing to the common good through a hands-on approach to legal education, leading to a cutting-edge understanding and application of the law. The School of Law will also move to its new state-of-the-art home this summer, built with the needs of today's students in mind. We've made National Jurist Magazine's Best Value Law School for 8 years in a row, and were named a top 50 go-to law school by the National Law Journal in 2016. If Undisclosed has inspired your interest to study the law, we encourage you to start your journey toward a legal career by visiting the University of South Carolina School of Law at law.sc.edu.